Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
That's Pete.
I'm Pete. That's Ben.
I'm Ben, his co-host in this, our sixth episode of The Henson Perspective, covering the 45th anniversary of the original New York broadcasts of The Muppet Show in America. 45 years ago today, on October 25th, 1976, the eighth production episode of The Muppet Show, featuring special guest star Paul Williams. This episode, Peter, was nominated for an Emmy for comedy writing. Oh. In fact, there were three nominations for the first season of The Muppet Show, in addition to the episode that won for Best Guest or Best Single Appearance. This was nominated for comedy writing, and the overall show just got a Comedy Emmy nomination. Of the episodes that we've looked at so far, and acknowledging that this is production episode number 8, so maybe depending on the calendar, they had the whole season to choose from, or maybe they had to submit fairly early on. How do you feel about this episode as comedy that they thought this shows us in our best light?
I think this is pretty strong, actually. We'll get into it more as we talk about the episode, but I think this improves on aspects and complaints that we've had, or I've had in other episodes.
It's the first tight episode.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first one where there are through jokes in that almost have an A and a B story. There's a through joke with the guest, and there's a through joke with the backstage, and then the additional sketches are, you know, don't necessarily have to lock on to that theme. But it is the first one that gives an indication of we're trying to have something be internally consistent throughout.
Don't tell me which guest is the winner until after I've rated that guest. Unless it was the Rita Moreno thing that we
It was the Rita Moreno
one. Okay. Never mind. Then I knew that. I did know that.
Yes. Yeah. No. Rita Moreno won for Best Guest. This was nominated for Best Writing, and then the show was nominated for Overall Comedy.
Okay.
The show goes on to have many more Emmy nominations and wins over the course of the 5 seasons. But for the first season, 3 Emmy noms is strong.
Yeah.
And I think goes to some indication as to the popularity of the show, as Paul Williams himself says.
30 million people.
I wasn't able to verify that number at all. Well, I spent a little bit of time trying to do so.
Also, considering this was recorded before any of the episodes had probably even aired.
Also true. Most spectacularly true. It was recorded from June 22nd to June 24th.
Yep, so that would be
in 1976.
3 months prior to air.
And the only statistic I was able to find is that there were viewing figures for England from the first series, which was approximately 14 million viewers.
Mm-hmm.
But because it was syndicated, as we've talked about before, it didn't have the same kind of ratings tracking that pure network shows had. Because it was done by affiliate choice, the numbers were not part of the top 50 CBS shows that they tracked, which is disappointing in that it's not immediately easy with an amateur Google to come up with a fast answer. I live in hope that I'll be able to get better answers to this question as time goes by.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get started, as we frequently do, by doing a rundown of the non-guest specific segments. We will then pivot into Peter quizzing me about special guest star Paul Williams, at which point we will talk about the Williams-centric sketches and then wrap up with statistics on the episode and how they contribute to the season so far, and end with our top 5 moments from the episode.
The episode starts with the credits, as usual. Fozzie's joke is very good.
New York is so crowded, even the cemeteries have standing room only.
Good joke.
The picture of Paul Williams is with a bunch of assorted Muppets crowding around him at the talk spot wall.
Mm-hmm. Which I noticed the first time I'd watched this episode, this is the first time I'd ever seen this episode ever. And not knowing what was going to happen later in one of the Paul Williams sketches, seeing Scooter next to Paul Williams, I was like, those two people look alike.
They have an uncanny resemblance.
Yes. And then Gonzo hits the O in Muppet Show and just shakes, which is a repeat from episode 105.
Oh, interesting.
I wrote in my notes, I was like, I feel like we've seen that before. And in research found we have.
One of the reasons I decided to lead this episode with the question of how did we feel about it in terms of stellar comedy writing as a possible nomination is there were a couple of minor elements that made me say, hang on, that's not really a fully formed moment. They could have done better than that. And I'd say the major two that stick out in my mind are Gonzo hitting the gong. And the other one is the ending of what happens next, where Kermit comes out to introduce the guest. After talking about the fact that Paul Williams is a cute little guy, and we're not going to make fun of his height.
But he's such a cute little fellow, we're going to make him an honorary Muppet.
There's a circular wipe that is very sudden and feels like there was more to that introduction that was cut. It doesn't have the tone and pitch of that was our final line. It goes up at the end as if he's going to say more, but then it radiuses in on transitioning to the first sketch of the show. It's one of the three things that sort of rings false, but the first thing, unfortunately, is Gonzo hitting the gong so hard that he also vibrates, which isn't necessarily successfully communicated.
Yeah, it took me the second watch for me to realize that that's what had happened. Well, after Kermit introduces Paul Williams and makes a short joke, by the way, only stat I have of this episode, because there's no hitting, no kissing, and no explosions to this episode, is the number of, not different short jokes, but the number of occasions of short jokes that are made up at Paul Williams' expense.
And, of course, one short joke that's not made at Paul Williams'
yes.
expense. It cuts to backstage.
No.
No.
Do we have another example of Ben didn't get this bit?
Apparently, according to the viewing of the early 2000s DVD release, that zero cut goes directly to backstage with Fozzie talking to Scooter.
So when that happens, does a creature come from offstage behind Fozzie and like make a little noise at Fozzie?
No, I don't believe so.
Interesting. So there's a song that happens here called All of Me, where two Muppets are singing a song.
I know the song.
Yeah.
It's a very popular classic song. It's the kind of thing that Wayne and Wanda would do.
So it's two creature Muppets, and one of them has like a big bushy eyebrows and eyes and a nose and big lips. And every time he says,
take my lips.
He gives him his lips.
Take my arms. I'll never use them.
The other Muppet has a box, which is what he's carrying as he crosses from behind Fozzie.
Mm-hmm.
So every time he says one of these things, lips, arms, eyes, heart, hair, nose, ears, chest, and hand, he takes them off of himself and puts it in this box.
Interesting. Now, I've seen this sketch, so I wonder if I could have seen it on Nick Jr., as we've established, where they had full episodes there. Fascinating that for whatever rights or squeamish reason, it didn't make it onto the season cut.
It's probably rights, since it's a famous song. So then, yes, then after that happens, we cut to backstage.
The Muppet with the box that contains all the pieces comes in from stage and walks behind Fozzie.
Yep, as he's reading his script of
10 minutes of jokes here in the War of 1812.
Which is such a good concept.
especially considering how short the telephone bit actually is.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it got cut down from 10 minutes of jokes is what he was preparing to
setup and punchline. That's it.
Yeah. But we're getting ahead of ourselves on that.
We're getting slightly ahead of ourselves on that. It's common parlance to refer to a tight five as a unit of comedy. And so the idea of 10 minutes of jokes on the War of 1812 feels A, desperate, and B, the opposite of a tight five.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so Scooter comes in and tells him, instead of doing that, we should just do the old telephone pole bit.
Mm-hmm.
And Fozzie tells him he works alone, doesn't want to do it, but they decide to do it anyway. I don't really understand how that actually worked out.
I think it's left in limbo. The sketch ends with Kermit walking past in the background, commenting on their conflict.
No, you don't tell jokes in the telephone pole bit.
Why not?
Well, you're the telephone pole.
Cute idea.
Mm-hmm. At which point Fozzie says, well, yeah, we'll see. He's leaving dubious. But by you're right. By the time we get to the next bit of this runner, he's legitimately practicing to be a telephone pole. So he's been won over while other things have been going on.
Yeah.
But his initial excitement for the bit is because it's a classic bit.
It's a classic!
It's a classic?
Yeah!
Oh, terrific. I can use it. Tell me. What is it?
Okay. I thought this was telling about, as we talk about the development of Fozzie's character over this season, when he hears that it's a classic joke, he's excited to do it.
Mm.
He knows that it's worked, therefore, for somebody else. He doesn't need it to be original. All he needs is something that will kill.
Mm-hmm.
What's the stopper for him is when he discovers that he would be doing it with Scooter.
Which is also interesting. So the parallel to this episode is the classic banana sketch
that we talked about in a previous episode.
Which I find interesting that Kermit didn't know the quote-unquote most famous sketch of all time, the banana sketch, but does know the old telephone pole bit.
But is also dismissive.
Mm-hmm. Dismissive, but still on board with it, where the banana sketch, he was dismissive and didn't want to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
But in that one, Fozzie was willing to work with a partner.
Right. After that, we then have
the first Paul Williams number.
Right.
Then
with Kermit coming out to introduce him with no jokes, no nothing, just genuine praise.
Yep. Just a singer, actor.
And it's a real treat to have him here.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, that is a good introduction to the song because both these songs, and we'll talk about this later, are done almost entirely without an attempt to make them overtly comic.
Yes, the performances themselves. There are funny...
about as straight music video as possible.
Yeah, this one is comedic, where the other one is not at all.
Yeah, yeah. But even this one, yeah, this one, well, anyway, we'll get back to this. Keep to the structure, Russell.
So then we have Statler and Waldorf yep.
commenting on it with a good joke.
He's a credit to his race.
What race is that?
The 100-yard dash.
Sort of the perfect Statler and Waldorf dynamic. Does this count as one of your short jokes?
No.
It totally is.
Because it's a short race?
Yes.
Mm, all right. I guess I'll count it.
Aha, that's why I brought it up.
Then we have our very first Muppet Labs.
First in the entire season, the first appearance of Dr. Bunsen Honeydew, the first Muppet News Labs, and it was good to realize that this was a Dave Goles character on a couple of different levels. One, because Gonzo is in one of the two group songs, but otherwise totally absent from this episode.
Dave Goles is the voice of the singer of All of Me. Because I made a comment by saying, that is almost Gonzo, but not Gonzo.
It's very much an All of Me sort of thing. Okay, that's interesting. So the episode is more Dave Goles than I realized. I specifically think that as we continue to talk about Gonzo over the course of this season, we'll talk about his evolution to madcap artist from sort of sad sack weirdo. And that the weirdo label becomes something that he embraces joyously, but it starts off very much as one of the reasons why he's kind of depressed and an outsider, is that he wants to be a weirdo, but it also punishes him. And I think, based on past interviews I've read, that worried Goles. Like, he was already slightly concerned that he wasn't as good of a Muppet performer as some of the other people, and he was playing a character that was down and feeling like they weren't good enough. And I think that that was an emotional loop in the performer that made him uncomfortable. But Bunsen Honeydew is so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
He's so big and bubbly and buoyant, And it gives me pleasure to think that Dave must have loved playing him, especially because he's a two-hander puppet. He's like the Swedish Chef and like Rolf. And at this stage, Gonzo is such a limited stick-and-rod puppet that he isn't particularly expressive yet. And I think that Honeydew must have been something that helped Goals feel like he could do different characters and that he could expand his physical ability as a performer.
Mm-hmm. I also just learned that this sketch was cut in the Nickelodeon edit, so you wouldn't have seen this on Nick Jr.
I think that this is a brilliant sketch. The basic premise is that they're introducing...
Folks, let me take just one moment of your time to acquaint you with a fascinating new product. It's Muppet's All-Purpose Tenderizer.
I've never used meat tenderizer, have you?
Sparingly.
But the fact that it's a thing, as far as I can tell, it's just salts and spices that you can rub into a meat.
It breaks up the protein and makes it softer.
Okay. There's also, of course, a pointed hammer that looks like something out of a Play-Doh Fun Factory that is also called a meat tenderizer. That makes slightly more sense to me in terms of a thing. So the idea of a sprinkling everything tenderizer is a good gimmick. And while Honeydew starts off from the get-go in front of computers and very much in a laboratory thing, this also has the feeling of an infomercial or a sales pitch as much as anything else. It has less of a we're pushing the boundaries of science and more we're bringing these products factory direct to you quality to his pitchmanship. And the fact that it then goes wrong or is used in ways on things that you can't really anticipate why somebody would want to have a soft, tenderized ceramic plate or a spaghetti droopy ladle.
Ooh, well, that's one of the problems with dishes, isn't it? They do tend to break. But if you had used all-purpose tenderizer, your dish would have been as tender as this.
The end to that he's accidentally tenderized the table, that and the ladle, I thought particularly, were really good special effects.
Yep, agreed.
In-camera work that allowed it to start off as a hard surface and then transform into a soft surface. It was so well done,
mm-hmm.
And it all happened without cuts.
Yeah.
In a way that I thought added to the fun.
Yep. It's the same technique that makes Swedish Chef so good as well.
Absolutely.
After this, we have another Statler and Waldorf commenting about science and how science can put a man on the moon, but they can't put a moon on a man.
Peter, is this a joke?
Technically, yes.
Because there's a reversal?
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
It's a joke. That doesn't mean it's funny, but it's a joke.
I did like the fact that, in this case at least, Waldorf also didn't necessarily think it was a joke.
Yeah, it's good that they will be grumpy with each other if necessary as well. Then we have a poem by Rolf titled Silence, which I enjoyed this a great deal.
I love this as a sketch.
Mm-hmm.
I do. I wonder sometimes whether it works as a poem and whether or not that helps ruin my enjoyment of the sketch. It's such a well-written series of bits that allow for escalation. For those who haven't seen the sketch, Ralph is reading a poem about silence, and in the metaphors about the power of silence, he continues to use words like singing or drumming that then have people come on stage to perform those actions literally instead of the metaphoric sense that they have in the poem.
But over all the blessed silence falls sweet serpentines of silence singing their sad song.
Which then allows the stage to be full of people making noise.
Which Rolf eventually loses his cool and yells at them to be quiet, and they do. And then he finishes his poem, and then Kermit comes out and tells him,
Could you hold it down, Ralph? We're trying to do a show here.
And there are only a couple of the contrasts between the metaphors that make me say, I can see somebody writing a lyric or a poem about silence drumming in your ears, or that silence sweeps away the cares of the day. But all of them in a row together feels like there isn't enough internal consistency of the exploration of the concept. And I don't know if my irritation with that is something that anybody else would care about.
I can say, from my perspective, nope.
That as an escalation of more and more lunacy coming on screen, that's all that mattered to make the joke successful.
Correct.
Fair. If I hadn't heard this and listened to this so many times, I probably would have been there myself.
Mm.
But I'm also, you know, I've been listening to a number of podcasts recently that talk about when you make creative things in a fictional universe, do those things need to withstand criticism? Does Rolf's poem need to be good in order for this sketch to be good?
There's bad poetry everywhere.
Ah, okay. According to my playlist, the next sketch is a Williams sketch.
Yes.
Is that true?
That is accurate. So we'll skip that, even though it's a real short sketch. Oh, that's... Ugh. Let's just talk about it since I made that terrible joke.
Yeah.
Because I listed the sketch as being called Paul Williams is Short.
I mean, that's basically what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. He comes on stage, says how happy he is to be there again, and he's happy to be working with the Muppets because...
Except for me, the entire cast is Muppets. Muppets are little, tiny things. For the first time in my life, no one will make jokes about how short I am.
But then three human-sized Muppets come out. Sweetums, a character named Thog, and a mutation all
the
come
mutation
out.
The mutation is the
big blue
the
one.
Purple... No, that's the orange-faced dancer that we've seen in various... Those are the mutations.
Gotcha. Come out and tower over Paul Williams. And that's the end of sketch.
It's a good visual bit.
It is. But also, so far, besides the song that he's sung that we'll talk about in a moment, everything about Paul Williams has been Paul Williams is Short. Like, it's the only jokes they have.
It's not a real high concept.
Yeah.
And that's, again, part of the heart of what interests me about the nomination and the Emmy for comedy writing about this episode. Like, it's tight. It's so much tighter than the banana sketch episode. On the other hand, they're not sophisticated examinations of anything. It's kind of playground humor more than anything else.
Yeah. Then we have another backstage where Fozzie is practicing to be a telephone pole. And Hilda comes in and says no one would believe that he's a telephone pole. And as she says that, a phone lineman comes by stringing phone wire and leaves it over Fozzie's nose.
While singing Wichita lineman lyric, I am a lineman for the county.
Yeah.
Which I laughed at particularly because that song is fairly well known to me and it was a good pop culture reference. I think it probably would have worked even better for the people at the time.
Yeah, I had no idea what song that was.
We cut to At the Dance, where we have our normal five gags. None of these jokes particularly jumped out at me except the middle one.
That man is annoying me.
He isn't even looking at you.
That's what's annoying me.
I mentioned that only because it did make me laugh, as did the loud lady in the fourth joke.
Yep.
But also because this is another example of Muppeteers on the day just doing a voice because it's convenient. That is Janice being played by Fran Brill, as opposed to being played by who she's been typically up to this point, Aaron Osker.
Well, actually, in my notes that I'm looking at, Janice is played by Fran Brill in Silence.
Oh, okay. Thank you. That's my bad notes then.
Aaron Osker is Janice in Dancing and Animal's Dancing Partner.
Okay. All right, that makes much more sense, because it did sound like Aaron Osker.
But right. In Silence, they are their code word is Whisper, so
yep.
Janice doesn't
you
actually
can
say
get away
anything.
With it.
Yeah,
yep.
It's just...
Yeah. Do you know who Fran Brill is as a Muppeteer?
No idea.
Fran Brill is mostly associated with Sesame Street. She is the voice of both Zoe and Prairie Dawn.
Yes.
And as Prairie Dawn, she is exceptional. I have a real soft spot in my heart for the Prairie Dawn character on Sesame Street. I love her tiny blonde bossiness. There's something about that kind of petite powerhouse that I think is a lot of fun. that I'm not going to take any crap from anybody little girl thing is a wonderful role model. And I've always been glad that Fran Brill exists and has played that character for generations of kids.
Well, let's continue singing her praises, because in the next sketch, she's right. The voice of Mary Louise.
But Mary Louise was not Fran Brill the last time we saw her in Never Smile at a Crocodile.
True.
In that case, I believe she was played by Raleigh Hewson. I've written this badly. Raleigh's a classic backstage Muppet designer, costumer, and engineer, and doesn't come on camera as often. And so for her to have done the puppet work for Mary Louise in Never Smile was kind of a rare thing. And I don't wish to say anything ill about that performance, especially because I know how much you enjoyed it.
I do.
But I think that Brill's performance of Mary Louise in this is kind of the perfect example of what people think of when they think of the funny Muppet dance. Like, she looks directly at camera, she does the mouth open, she does the arms out, she does the sachet to side to side. Like, Fran Brill doing that on Sesame Street is part of why everybody thinks of that as the Muppet dance. And it therefore makes me happy to see Mary Louise basically vamping up a storm in front of a chorus of frogs in I'm in Love with a Big Blue Frog. Her distinct physical style of Muppet dance puppeteering, I love.
So, interesting note.
Yeah.
According to the Muppet Fandom Wikia, Fran Brill did not puppeteer Mary Louise in this sketch.
But only sang it.
Yeah, she was puppeteering Robin the Frog instead.
I'm not sure that's true. If you look at that same Wikia, there's a backstage photograph at the bottom of all the photos that has her with her arm up Mary Louise, which I was very interested to look at that photograph because it shows that Jim is actually doing Kermit,
mm-hmm.
which I was suspicious of. I was suspicious that it wasn't Jim because Kermit's actions
you never hear
in this
his voice.
Sketch, correct. Rock, rock, rock. Ribbit, ribbit, ribbit.
Rock, rock, rock. Ribbit, ribbit, ribbit. So in this list of performers, they don't actually yep. have Mary Louise otherwise listed as who did puppeteer her. They just say Mary Louise voice for her. So I have no proof as to who did, and you have evidence physically that she was. So,
well, if I can identify a slightly not the best web transfer photograph, it looks like Fran Brill to me, but also I may be wrong.
But it's a good song. I liked it a lot. It does have a very cringeworthy moment, though.
What is the cringeworthy moment, in your opinion?
In the line of
placing values on their property will go right down if the family next door is blue.
See?
Oof.
It's interesting that you think that's cringeworthy. I think that's temporal satire. Like, when this song was performed by Peter, Paul, and Mary in 1967.
Yeah.
That was written as satire of the kind of people that would hate it if the family next door was black.
True.
They were saying that kind of behavior is silly and bad, being liberal folk singers extraordinaire.
Yeah, that all checks out. It was still enough to raise my hackles and just be like, ooh, a little bit. But yeah, you're probably totally right that it is meant negatively towards those people who would be upset by this.
That the family next door is blue.
Yeah.
Forget about frogs. Just the color.
Well, I mean, most people don't mind the French, so it's fine.
And no, that's not me doing a French accent.
Sure sounded like it to me.
This is the UK spot.
Yes.
So it is therefore highly unlikely that the Statler and Waldorf connective tissue that happens after this bit is in the episode either, where they essentially do the a cappella frog chorus.
Yeah, they liked this so much that they wanted to sing it, sing along.
Crum, 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 creamy, creamy, creamy.
And so therefore, U.S. audiences would have come back probably directly to the talk spot, mm-hmm. which is a Paul Williams bit. So we will get back to it.
After the talk spot is backstage number 3, where Fozzie is still practicing to be a telephone pole. And this time a little bird, woodpecker, lands on his shoulder and starts pecking him in the face.
We then have a Paul Williams sketch where Paul is playing a character. And then we cut to the houses in the street.
Unlike the last time we talked about the houses, this one worked for me. I understood this joke because it was very clear.
Yes, but it's also the same joke.
Yeah, but this one works.
The joke is my mother, says one of the houses,
is very religious. And then the other house says, she's a fanatic. And the first house says, no, she's a church.
Right. The previous joke was, my brother, the hotel, is thinking about...
I hear your son, the hotel, has become interested in religion. The other house says, oh, interested isn't the word. He's seriously thinking about becoming a monastery.
And the idea that a building could change into another kind of a building was something for you that was hard to wrap your head around.
Right, but this isn't change. This is, she is very religious. No, she's a church.
She started off religious.
And she...
Her physicality is religious. Therefore, she would be religious.
Yes.
It's not a joke.
Sure it is.
And it is basically, I mean, I get that it's a more obvious version of the previous joke, but that's what bugged me, is it's like they were going back to the previous joke and saying, all right, well, that one didn't work. Let's boil it down to its basic principles and try it again, which made it feel repetition.
Which is interesting because you're right about that. This is a more successful version of the banana sketch, the telephone pole bit. And this episode won an Emmy for best comedy writing.
No, didn't. Nominated.
Oh, nominated. But still.
Was submitted for.
So they thought that, oh, our first drafts of all these jokes didn't work, but these second drafts, that's where we're going to get them.
If we were really good at this podcast, we would know what episodes these previous versions of these jokes had appeared on, so we could also compare production order.
But we're not.
All right, so Sandy Duncan was the banana sketch.
Yes.
And that was production order 14.
Okay.
This is, therefore, the more refined version and tighter because they worked on it previously. However, the houses I have not yet been easily able to put my hand on as to which episode that occurred in.
It was the Ruth Buzzy episode.
Which is production order 6, if I'm not mistaken. And this is production order 8. So that is legitimately could be interpreted as they were trying to go back to basics and make a joke work, whereas the other narrative doesn't work. This isn't a tighter version of the banana sketch. The banana sketch is a looser version of this first foray.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, Wayne and Wanda, Sam the Eagle introduces them. Wayne and Wanda are revealed as a magician and magician's assistant. And
as Wayne saws through the box that has Wanda in it.
And as she sings, you do something to me. But as soon as he gets halfway through the box, he starts sawing into her and she screams and the sketch ends.
It is appropriate that this is the only, well, I was going to say it's the only really old song in the number, but I didn't know about the first musical number. I was also going to comment about how little music there was in this number, but I didn't know about the first. I'll be interested to see how the stats shake out with your statistics versus mine. Cole Porter wrote You Do Something to Me in 1929 for a musical, I believe, called 5 Million Frenchmen Can't Be Wrong.
Interesting.
The basic premise of the title was it was an anti-prohibition musical, and so they were saying, if you can drink and fool around in Paris, then surely we should be also doing that in the United States. 5 million Frenchmen can't be wrong. I bring it up only because the title legitimately made me chortle when I found it on Wikipedia.
Yeah, that's very good. So yes, then we have a Muppet Newsflash, which we'll talk about later because it features our guest star.
And then finally, we go backstage in order to find out that Fozzie has discovered what the telephone bit actually is, and he's refusing to participate.
Yeah, I didn't get this, because it felt like he knew all along. Like, he let on, I thought, that he knew what it was.
No. The very initial concept is he's never heard of the telephone.
Oh.
Which is why Scooter is doing that thing very early on where he says, picture it! You stand in front of the curtain. We come out, and it's the we that gets Fozzie to stop and say, to hold it right there. So he actually gets to the part where he's describing. The fact that Fozzie's been going into character as the telephone pole in his method acting backstage was a jump of Fozzie channeling something he didn't need to do. He knew, he got told by Scooter that he was the telephone pole in the telephone pole bit. The line is, you don't tell jokes in the telephone pole bit.
Right.
Which I misunderstood the first time I heard it. I was like, wait, are they doing some sort of weird art bit? But what Scooter is emphasizing is you, Fozzie, as the telephone pole, you don't tell jokes in the telephone pole bit. And what Fozzie has finally discovered is that the telephone is the straight man in the telephone pole bit.
Yes and no, though, because without what Fozzie says,
the punchline can't land.
Yeah. Even then, I think the fact, what, well, let's just talk about it. So,
yeah,
the curtain comes up and Fozzie is dressed as a telephone.
Correct. Not a telephone pole.
And
his face is sticking out of the rotary dial of a box telephone.
Right. And Scooter says, hello, and what's your name? And Fozzie responds, Mike Osnowski, meaning he's Polish.
And Scooter says, oh, you're the telephone pole.
Right. Also, first time I watched this, didn't get it. I was like, there's all this buildup for that. And it was on the second watch that I was like, oh, it's a Polish name. I now
it's
understand.
A Polish joke. I mean, you want to talk about cringeworthy. I consider that to be much worse than the earlier satirical joke about blue people bringing down the tone of the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. According to the notes on the Muppet Fandom Wikia, it is an homage to Frank Oz's father, whose name was Mike Osnowitz.
Yep, and so making it extra Polish by adding the ski on the end of it.
Yep.
Now, as somebody who is a defender of the Shaggy Dog joke as a tradition, I have to defend this sketch conceptually. All that buildup for a bad punchline is the heart of the Shaggy Dog joke, and I believe in the form. However, this did not land for me.
See, I liked it once I got it the second time.
Huh.
I'm now a fan.
I think my interpretation of the Shaggy Dog joke is that it has to be delivered in a manner like the Aristocrats. You have to go for it. You have to say the last punchline with all the vim and vigor of, this was worth it, when it's not. And Scooter doesn't deliver,
oh, so you're that telephone pole,
in a way that captures that same ruthless, and I just wasted your time energy that to me is inherent to the Shaggy Dog joke. I think Scooter believes in the joke.
But Fozzie doesn't.
A person who's telling a Shaggy Dog joke knows that the punchline is worthless.
But what about the fact that Fozzie didn't want to do the joke, but still does it anyway?
I think Fozzie's humiliation is mm-hmm. mildly funny. I think the delivery of the joke and the that's not worth it-ness of it doesn't land.
Okay.
I think it's interesting that it does for you.
Hmm. Then we cut to Statler and Waldorf, where they say Fozzie has never been funnier, or never been better, or shorter, because this was the shortest Fozzie bit of...
That's right. It wasn't 10 minutes of jokes about the War of 1812.
Yeah.
Yes. The short joke that I alluded to earlier that's not about Paul Williams.
Mm-hmm.
We then have the second and final of Paul Williams' musical numbers, and then the farewell with the guest star, and Statler and Waldorf's final joke is that Waldorf, I believe, says that...
Yeah, this show is good for what ails me.
Yeah? Well, what ails you?
Insomnia.
Which I thought was the best Statler and Waldorf closer we've had so far.
Mm-hmm. It was very good. Especially because the first time I watched this, it was 11:30 at night, and I was ready to go to bed.
But that is pitch perfect what I want out of a Statler and Waldorf joke, is it's insulting and it's still a good joke in and of itself.
Well, it's time to get into our Paul Williams segment. And since we've talked about how many short jokes there have been, this mm-hmm. leads perfectly into my first question, if you are ready for your Paul Williams quiz.
Oh my gosh. The first question is going to be, how tall is Paul Williams, isn't it?
Yep. The question reads, many jokes are made about Paul Williams' height in this episode. According to IMDb, how tall is Paul Williams?
Okay.
Is he 5'0", 5'2", or 5'4"?
Whew. 5'4".
He's 5'2", according to IMDb. Besides being a singer, Paulie Williams is also an actor. Which of the following movies that have had an impact, positive or negative, on my life has Paul Williams not been in? A. A Million to One. B. Dude, Where's My Car? Or C. The Rules of Attraction?
So he's in two out of those.
Correct.
All right. I'm pretty sure Paul Williams is in Rules of Attraction, and I don't know why. So between the other two, which do I think is more likely to have had a short songwriter in it? Dude, Where's My Car?
That is correct.
Oh!
As soon as I saw that Paul Williams was in A Million to One, I knew I had to include this in the quiz. Number three, Paul Williams is also a voiceover actor. Which of the following cartoon TV shows has Paul Williams not done a voice for? A. Batman the Animated Series. B. The Tick. Or C. X-Men.
The Tick.
That is incorrect. He is the voice of the Mother of Invention in the episode Leonardo da Vinci and His Fightin' Genius Time Commandos. The correct answer is X-Men.
So who is he in Batman the Animated Series?
He is the voice of Penguin and Oswald Cobblepot.
I'm shocked I didn't know that.
Question number four. Paul Williams has written music for many films, such as the scores for Bugsy Malone, The Muppet Movie, Ishtar, The Muppet Christmas Carol, and The Princess Diaries 2, Royal Engagement. He also wrote a song for the 1976 Barbra Streisand version of A Star Is Born.
Mm-hmm.
Besides the 2018 Lady Gaga Bradley Cooper version, which is the other version of A Star Is Born to have won an Oscar for Best Original Song? Is it the 1937 version? Is it the 1954 version? Or is it the 1976 version?
It's the 76 version.
Yeah, it is. That was pretty much a gimme question. Question number five. Paul Williams was listed by which pop star as their, quote, favorite performer, end quote?
Wow, I am intrigued to hear this list.
A. Lord. B. Miley Cyrus. Or C. Taylor Swift.
Miley Cyrus.
Incorrect. You have fallen for my trap.
Ugh.
This was a trick question because Lord said this about New Zealand comedian Paul Williams, who is the assistant to the Taskmaster in the New Zealand version of Taskmaster. Well, so thanks to my trickery, you still got
two.
Two out of five correct. Perfect.
What I was hoping you were going to include some biographical information about is the infamous film that he wrote the music for and performed in, Phantom of the...
Yes. Phantom of the Paradise.
Thank you. Phantom of the Paradise, if I recall correctly, was one of these things that existed in a post-Rocky Horror universe and was widely panned and is yet regaining a certain notoriety of people rediscovering it now that everything is camp and we are now celebrating everything that's trash. I don't begrudge anybody loving camp, and I don't begrudge anybody looking back at a thing that people put hours and months of their creative energies into and finding it to be valuable. Those are both wonderful things. I'm personally allergic to camp, and so it's not my flavor, but I'm therefore interested in it as a production and what people would like about it. I suspect, were I to watch it and or listen to the soundtrack album, the skin would crawl off my body and stuff itself into my ears in order to prevent me from having to deal with it anymore.
Fair. I'd never heard of it before, so that's why. Okay. I did not do anything with it, because I was like, that's something I don't know anything about.
That's a black box.
Yep.
I'm not going to open that.
He's fascinating.
Wrote songs for Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, including a song called When the Rivers Meet the Sea, which Elton John goes on to sing on the Muppet Christmas album.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, as you previously mentioned, wrote the songs or co-wrote the songs to the Muppet movie. So has a long and storied connection to the Muppets, is basically, I think, one of the most important factors in helping make the Muppets universal. The songs in the Muppet movie are some of the most beloved Muppet moments out there. Rainbow Connection is a really good song, and it helps that it's sung by a frog with a banjo, but it would also be, you can picture it being covered by somebody that he would have sold it to, like the Birds or Three Dog Night or something like that, and that it would have been a minor, easy listening radio hit, even if it hadn't been in the Muppet movie.
Yeah. Yeah, he co-wrote that with a man named Kenneth Asher.
Mm-hmm. Ken Asher and he collaborated on a number of things, I believe, including the Star Is Born soundtrack work. He's a pianist, Asher, which I think is interesting because the Muppet Facts trivia track on the DVD goes some lengths to point out that Paul Williams is not a pianist and yet constantly appears at the piano in Muppet events. He plays the pianist at the El Slizo bar in the Muppet movie, despite not being able to play the piano. He worked with a really good pianist who co-wrote his songs, which is why pianos are so prominent in them. But Williams himself was not a piano player, and therefore, when he occasionally makes live performances of Muppet songs, he will fake playing the piano in order to accompany the song that was written by his co-writer.
Interesting. My last fact about Paul Williams is that he also co-wrote and performed on the Daft Punk album Random Access Memories.
That's a great fact!
And as a matter of fact, when that album won in the 2014 Grammys for Album of the Year, he accepted it on their behalf with Nile Rodgers and gave a speech for them because they are non-speaking entities.
That's brilliant. Good trivia, Pete. Unless we've got anything else, let's move on to talking about Paul Williams' contributions to this episode. His first appearance is after Kermit gives him his heartfelt, genuine introduction. He sings Just an Old-Fashioned Love Song, which is a Paul Williams song that originally appeared on his, I believe, second studio album in 1971. The album and the song, the single, are called Just an Old-Fashioned Love Song. This is an attic room with rain on the window and Paul singing directly to camera next to an antique radio, which, when we get to the chorus of the song, opens up and a Paul Williams Muppet comes out and joins him for them to sing in two-part harmony.
That's just an old-fashioned love song, humming down in two-part harmony.
The Muppet then goes back into the radio, and for the next come round of the chorus, a second and third Paul Williams Muppet come out in order for them to sing in three-part harmony, and they're joined by a veritable New Orleans street festival of musicians.
It is once again the Gogolala Jug Band.
Yes. So, Pete, with the exception of the fact that you have two chippy Paul Williams Muppets, and the fact that the Muppet characters are wildly enthusiastic, this is basically a straight musical number.
Mm-hmm. But the song's catchy as hell, so I'm in.
Interesting. Then here's a couple of mild trivia bits from Wikipedia about this song. He had written it for the Carpenters.
Oh.
He had also written Rainy Days and Mondays for the Carpenters and offered this specifically for them. And Richard Carpenter said, no, I don't like it. And so he instead sold it to Three Dog Night.
Mm-hmm.
They released it on their album titled Harmony and released it as a single in November of 1971, whereas Williams also released it as the album Old Fashioned Love Song in 1971. So there were two versions of the same song the same year on the radio by the songwriter and the person he sold it to. Which, I gotta say, there's some weird contract stuff in there that Wikipedia does not get into. They do not point out the fact that after you sell a song to a person, maybe you shouldn't undercut their sales by releasing their own version. The only footnote I have to that is that the album, Old Fashioned Love Songs, is Williams' second album with a particular label, which he then leaves for his next four albums. And the other songs on that album are also songs that he wrote for other performers. And I wonder if it was a get-out-of-obligation album. That he owed them an album, and so he filled it up with songs he'd already written in order to get out of his contract and to move on to greener pastures.
Which is interesting. So one more fact about this song. Three Dog Night, it topped the charts at number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100, so it certainly didn't necessarily eat
didn't hurt,
into
no.
Yeah,
interesting. Obviously, this is wild speculation on my part. This is me filling in dots in the absences of data on a Wikipedia page, most of which his albums are stubs. There is a biography or a documentary about his life, but as I was not allowed to research him, I did not dig into this particular detail. I was just looking up data on the songs and stumbled on that particular odd overlap. The song ends with all of the performers heading back into the radio. The last person to go in is a trumpeter who belts out a last couple bars of music, and on the button, the radio slams shut on his last note. And it's a very high energy. What starts off with solemn rain and wistful reminiscence in an attic room turns into a real party.
Yeah, I enjoyed this a great, great deal. I did think it was weird. The camera was placed low,
mm-hmm.
and the way Paul Williams sings, there's a lot of times where he's actually looking up and kind of, but also looking down his nose at the camera, and it's very off-putting. I don't like it at all.
It wasn't physically flattering to him as a performer. I wonder if there was something about the way in which the set needed to have a big gully behind him to have all the Muppet performers in it that would have revealed that if the camera was in almost any other position.
Yeah. I will also note that at this point in Paul Williams' life, he was a heavy drinker and substance abuser, and he has cleaned up his act and is now been sober for many, many years. So congrats to you, Paul Williams. But that may also be a factor on why this may not be necessarily the most flattering of times, because this was when he was in his real, real big, heavy area.
Some of his least healthy
moments.
I'll just point out that the Muppet version of Paul Williams is, as you alluded to earlier by saying he looked a lot like Scooter, is fun and funny. Mm-hmm. They have straight hair instead of wavy hair, so the resemblance isn't complete. But considering that we open with a joke from Kermit that they want to make him an honorary Muppet, to then instantly have actual Paul Williams Muppets is a good bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that it happens not long after the first two episodes, which we haven't talked about. The first two production episodes end with the performers being presented with a Muppet caricature of themselves in the final stage farewell. You get to see a Muppet version of the guest star. That goes away once we get out of those pilot episodes. So it's nice to see it coming back. And apparently Williams has one of the Muppet versions of himself on display on his piano in his home.
That's very cool. So then the next time we see Paul is in the Paul Williams' short sketch. After that, we go to the talk spot.
This is an extended riff on the idea of lifts.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, did you bother to check whether or not Wally Blattner actually was the creator of insole shoe heighteners?
I did not.
I didn't either. I just took it as read that with a wonderful name like Wally Blattner, he probably wasn't.
Mm.
But that he's credited here as the inventor of the elevator shoe. Which leads to two bits of physical business of the idea that an elevator shoe, if you press the button on it, could actually cause you to go up or go down. And the escalation of the joke is that Kermit presses Paul Williams' nose once he learns that he's wearing lifts, saying, "Going up!" And Paul Williams flies away.
Yep. I just gave it a quick Google, and if you Google Wally Blattner, you just get this episode.
That's because in the trades, he was Wallace Blattner, Peter.
True.
The man with respect.
Yeah. I really enjoyed Paul Williams, and as we talk about this, I still haven't determined where I'm going to rank him. But I feel so torn about it, because I like everything that he does. But I don't like the fact that the only joke they could have seemed to come up with are, he's short.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if he pitched it. I wonder if he came in and said, this is part of my reputation. This is a thing that, you know, has come up before in other talk show appearances. The Muppets as puppets gives us a different opportunity to play around with short jokes. And that it was him doing them all so that it couldn't be done anymore.
Okay, I suppose, because I was going to counter by saying, like, yeah, do one, but it's pretty much all they do when he's being himself. When he's being a character, they don't bring it up. But in every sketch where he's himself, it's brought up. And it just felt like it was too much. But your idea of get them all done so no one can do them again makes sense.
If that's true,
yeah.
It would be a saving grace. I agree that it's a limited mine that they can dig in terms of finding material. So I hope it was something valuable for him like that.
Yeah. The next sketch is a travel agent sketch, and I loved this sketch.
I mentioned with Rita Moreno that there was a strangeness for me in the when that she went into being a character. But I didn't mention with Ruth Buzzi that during the interrogation sketch, it just seemed normal for her to be playing a character.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that there was something about the way in which that sketch was set up with a very specific costume and with the lighting and the bars that you knew you were in a fictional universe. Here, Williams and the production staff do a good job of establishing he's playing a travel agent with his opening dialogue so that you know this isn't Paul Williams without having to do much else besides that.
Yeah, behind him he is a picture of New York City and some other, like, poster. So you know you're in an office. Yeah, he's
talking to a woman on the phone confirming her flight details.
Yeah, so you know right then and there.
This isn't Paul. This is somebody else.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am, you are confirmed. Two tickets to New York City. Thank you.
When a monster comes in and asks for needing to get to Pittsburgh, and Paul says, for $764, I can get you on a supersonic jet in first class. The monster says, I need something cheaper than that.
I could send you to Pittsburgh coach class on a subsonic jet for $511.
You got anything cheaper?
And so with every subsequent pitch, the price goes lower and the accommodations get worse. Until he eventually gets down to, I can give you standing room only on a broken down old bus for about $75. And that's still too expensive for the monster. So Paul Williams gets frustrated, pulls a hidden lever that the camera pans back to reveal when a 5,000-pound weight crushes the monster into a flat mat. And Paul Williams throws it off camera and says, just mail this for me.
The mechanics of this are great. They're able to have the weight come down. You're able to see the bottom of it so you know that it's not hollow, which is always the Monty Python trick, that you know that there's a man crouching underneath a hollowed out plywood, quote, weight, unquote. But because we've got the ability to do substitutions with different puppets and cuts here, there's just that extra little bit of panache to it that made me enjoy the way in which they executed this.
Yeah, it was good. And also, I was thinking when I was rewatching this back, so the prices go from $764 to $511 to $398 to $75 for the broken down bus.
Mm-hmm.
If my options were economy class on a Southwest jet for $398 or a supersonic first class for $764, I would take that upgrade every time.
The economics of that are in your favor.
Yeah, but nowadays, I'm not paying $1,600 for a first-class flight. No, sir.
I'm amused by the idea of a supersonic flight from New York to Pittsburgh. How long would that be? 12 minutes?
Yeah, probably. Then the Muppet Newsflash?
The guest stars in the Muppet Newsflash isn't something that we've talked a lot about. We talked about it a little bit with the Sandy Duncan sketch. But in general, these appearances of people playing minor characters in the Muppet Newsflash has not been a successful segment for me.
Yeah, especially this one where this is also a Shaggy Dog story, essentially.
Mm. It's an anti-joke.
Yeah, because they're talking about an unusual news story.
Arnold Stockman, a retired shoe salesman, recently had a most unusual experience, and we at Muppet News Central feel it is a story that should be shared with everyone.
And the news story is that Paul Williams' phone rang, and Paul Williams picked it up, and there was no one there. And that's weird.
And typically, the Muppet News Flash reactions of the anchor has been, where do we get these nuts? But in this one, he says, we bring you this story tonight because we want to share it with you, the Muppet News audience. He's in.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't seem abashed or confused or embarrassed that they aired this. He's signed off on it. So the whole thing is very much an anti-joke of, this isn't actually all that strange, but everybody's presenting it as such.
Mm-hmm.
In general, these performances by guest stars in the Muppet Newsflash hasn't been a successful thing for me. I think Williams sells the mundane existential moment of his character. I just don't care.
Yeah. There is a part of this episode that, if it comes down to it, I might mention as one of my top five moments. Hmm. But except for that moment, I do agree with you. It is blah at best. I do appreciate it.
Yeah, I think it's technically well done.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because I have become disillusioned with the guest star portion of the newsflash segments that I'm not giving this a chance. I think that everybody did a good job with what they were doing. It just doesn't work for me, and I can't put my finger on why.
Yeah.
The final Paul Williams moment is then the second Paul Williams song, which is called Sad Song, open parentheses, That Used to Be Our Song, close parentheses.
That's a sad song that used to be our song, and oh, she sang it too.
Which appears in 1974 on the Williams album A Little Bit of Love. The original length of this song on the album, Pete,
yeah,
is 6 minutes and 24 seconds.
Ooh, I would have been mad if that was the case.
What is it in the Muppet version, where it's a tight 2 verses?
It is exactly 2 minutes.
And it's just about perfect as an example of a song that shows that the Muppets can have emotional power, that they mm-hmm. can be silly, but they can also genuinely adapt, arrange, and perform a song with serious musical intent, and it can be emotionally affecting.
Yeah.
I think that's really one of the first times the show in broadcast order has attempted to accomplish this.
Well, I think that's partially to the credit of the guest, because he is a musician, so he knows how to perform. And also, we've talked in the past about there being Music Day and them yep. performing to tracks. I truly believe both the Paul Williams numbers were done live.
I disagree.
Oh, really? I could not find any seams to lip syncing. I thought he was doing an excellent job of, if it was to track, mimicking like the facial movements of when there was vibrato or whatever music is. I don't know.
So with the first number, you can tell that there is a sonic resonance, that there's an echo chamber that wouldn't have been on set. And so you can tell that that was recorded in a studio that makes that certain that that's pre-recorded.
Mm-hmm.
To your point about his visual performance of really expressing the songs, of giving them vibrato, of giving them, that's what tips me off to the fact that he's performing it in the second number. That face shaking that he's doing as he really leans into a couple of those notes isn't accompanied by a tightness of the neck and a vibrating of his Adam's apple and vocal cords. He's visually performing his head more than he's performing his mouth and his throat. And to my eye, the difference of tension in those things is because he's faking it, but that's what makes it work for you. And I think that that's excellent. I think that's probably a technique that is used by music video makers the world over, mm-hmm. that you want to make sure that you overdo it a little bit so that it's believable.
Yeah, because what trips me up is when the song has that and the performer doesn't do it.
Correct.
So I would much prefer the visual of it looking like they are, when in fact they are not.
I thought that this, particularly the arrangement of the Muppet chorus, much like what they... I'm going to retract my earlier statement. Sandy Duncan, production-wise, comes later, but the Sandy Duncan closing number of Remember a Night in September attempts to do this same thing of a heartfelt, genuine musical performance. And it even goes so far as to just have a chorus of Muppets show up on a hill and sing along. But I think that the back and forth between Williams singing the melody and the call and response of then the Muppets saying, sing, sing, and in response to what he's doing, creates a back and forth and a liveliness that really helps this one be successful.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the Sandy Duncan, where the Muppets are sort of unfortunately passive in that song.
Yeah.
Whereas there's a dialogue going on here between human and chorus.
Yeah. I agree. This one worked for me. Everything about this worked.
Well done, Paul. Well done, Sam Pottle and arrangers, or whomever was the musical behind-the-scenes people. The reason I continually think about the Emmy in this is I don't think of this as an exemplary comedy writing episode, but it's so tight in its performance aspects I think that there must be an aspect of the comedy writing Emmy that I don't understand, because this all worked very well, and it is the first episode that has a contained capsule quality to it that really, where everything fits together, that made me go, yeah, this is good. It doesn't feel like somebody would look at it and go, yes, this is good, because it's a well-written series of jokes.
Well, it was in the comedy for variety or music series category.
Yeah. So, yeah. And I think that's where I'm getting hung up, is that comedy is...
This would have been against Laugh-Ins or SNLs. This wouldn't have been against the whatever the Norman Lear sitcom was at the time.
Right. And that might be what I'm getting hung up on. It's obviously a comedy show.
Yeah.
But I therefore feel like I would want it to be my most laugh-a-minute script, which this isn't. But it does show good evidence of extraordinarily good production, and maybe that is in fact what these things get judged on.
Yeah. And then we have the outro, which we briefly touched on,
and the only thing that's interesting about it is that it's literally the same short joke. Mm-hmm. Even the same tall Muppets. We don't have the mutant, but otherwise it's the same pullback of just how short he is compared to those other human and superhuman Muppets.
Yep.
So how many short jokes does that make us?
I clocked it at 5, including the one that you
asked me to add in.
Yes. I didn't count the each individual short joke. I just said,
this is a passel of short jokes.
Yeah. So, oops. that's a lot of short jokes.
It's a tall order of short jokes.
Oh, boy.
What other stats did you track? We've talked about the amount of music in the episode.
Yep. So that's really the only other thing I have, because like, it was not a violent episode.
No, it was more of a gentle, elegiac episode.
Yeah, so with all the sketches that I saw in, there was 41.63% of the episode was music.
Wow.
11 minutes and 1 second out of 26 minutes and 27 seconds of show. If I take that out, it drops it to 36.83 minutes out of 24.27, which still would not be the least amount of music.
Okay.
With that taken out.
What is the least so far?
Episode 3, which would have been Sandy Duncan.
Okay.
I believe that is correct.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Just barely beats that out, but at 41.63, it's still right in the middle. Shall we move on to top 5 moments?
Top 5 moments. For anyone joining in, a moment is not a complete sketch, but it's a piece of performance or writing, a tiny bit of exemplary production that we want to stop and focus on and appreciate that makes us think or smile or consider. Pete, why don't you go first?
Since we were just talking about it, in Sad Song, I loved how subdued Animal was while he was drumming.
Interesting.
It was what I watched most.
I don't think I even noticed he was drumming.
Because it's a low and slow song.
Yeah.
He's doing the bare minimum, but his eyebrows are down the whole time, and he's just kind of sitting slumped over the kit, just doing the minimum that he needs to do. And I loved the fact that he was not being Animal. He was going with the flow of what the song called for.
That's fascinating. So Animal, of course, in the silence poem, when there's the silence is drumming in our ears, he then on a raised platform is pushed out onto the stage like he's in an amazing rock show and is drumming up a storm until Rolf finally freaks out and cancels everybody. At which point, when his platform then slowly goes back off stage, he is doing that same quiet drumming. Like he's basically silently drumming.
I didn't notice
as
that.
He goes back off stage. So it's almost in keeping with the episode that he practiced before he had to be there. I'm gonna go back and look for that. I was going to say, as one of my favorite moments, is the closer to that number where Rolf closes the piano lid and sort of touches it to say, and that's done. This marvelous little moment. And Williams interacts with Rolf as well, like notices him basically close the song and say, we're at peace.
Mm-hmm.
Especially amusing considering that was a 1/3 performance of the studio version of the song, to be like, yep, and that's done. That's all we need to say, when the actual song wanted to say that 2 more times. it's still, it's a beautiful little moment that helps reinforce the atmosphere that they were able to successfully perform an emotional piece of music without undercutting it at all. And that moment, I think, is the bow on that.
My next moment is going to be from the outro of the episode. It's another little tiny thing. After the two monsters come back out, the more Muppets come out, and Fozzie is one of them, stands in between the two tall monsters, takes off his hat like he often does, and then throws it into the audience, and then looks surprised at, wait, where'd my hat go? And then runs off.
Yeah, he's climbed the giant blue Muppet like he's a mountain, basically.
Yeah.
It's a blink and you'll miss it moment, except for the fact that because of the weird motion of the hat, it definitely caught my eye when I was taking notes. I was like, wait, what was that? What just happened? I missed something.
Yeah, because with his reaction, I thought someone, the first time I watched it, I noticed that, and I thought, oh, someone must have knocked his hat off. But no, he takes it off, throws it, and then is surprised that he threw it.
Surprised that it went somewhere.
Yeah.
I can't decide if I want to do this as my next moment, because it's a bit of a cheat. But in the trivia track, when the subtitles are listing Fran Brill's credits, they say that in addition to her Muppet and her Sesame Street work, she's known for some live-action appearances, and they credit her as being in Oliver Stone's Midnight Express. No, she's not. She's in Martin Brest's Midnight Run, where she plays the wife of Charles Grodin's character. And it just cracks me up that they got the titles wrong. The trivia track literally has a disclaimer. They have a little thing of Stam the Eagle saying, these facts are true to the best of our knowledge, but we may have gotten some things wrong because of the weirdos who worked on it. And I don't know if that's just a Sam joke, or if because there are, in fact, many things, or at least this thing wrong, and they're like, well, we could fix it, or we could just make a joke disclaimer. I don't know which came first, but for a couple of years since I found out that Fran Brill is in this very small part in Midnight Run, which has been one more reason for me to love the movie Midnight Run, it then particularly jumped out at me that they got the wrong Midnight movie in the trivia track.
Yeah, that is wild.
Anyway, if that counts as my number four, why don't you bring us home with number five?
All right. I have a lot in this episode, but since I brought it up earlier, I'm going to talk about the thing that I liked in the Muppet News Flash, which was the newsman's active listening in this.
He's squinting, he's grimacing, he's
looking at Paul Williams, and at one point he like nods his head up and down very quickly and goes, and that made me laugh so hard.
It's also interesting because you consider the special effectsness of it, that because Paul Williams is a burn-in on a blue screen, where is this being performed? Is this being done simultaneously on a second camera? Is this being done on tape, and then the newsman character, who I believe is Jim Henson, has to go along with a timing tape, but he's not actually seeing anything? Like, the special effectsness of it make it so that I'm not quite sure how the production of this performance lines up. But I like the fact that he's overemphasizing the realness of it, because it's not.
Yeah, and for me, that act of listening is what saves this sketch from being truly boring and mundane, because how interested he is in the mundaneness makes me laugh at how mundane it is.
Yeah, which drives home the additional point of that while normally these sketches are about the newsman getting flustered with the fact that these stories are ridiculous, he's in on this one. Like, he thinks it's important.
This is the news that they should be delivering.
That's right. And his performance absolutely amplifies that.
This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design, such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song is from archival Henson Associates clips of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use.
You can find us at farceperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at FarstNameBasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomenon.
There are things, dates, facts, travel prices, names, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website, and we will post it to our errata page on farstperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete. My co-host is Ben. And we will see you next time when we discuss production episode 11 starring Lena Horne. Yeah!